to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm Will Arimas. Hey everyone, welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We're recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, June 12th. On today's show, we'll talk about the electric scooters that are suddenly wreaking havoc on city streets and why Silicon Valley venture capitalists are swooning over them. We'll discuss the layoffs at Tesla and what they might mean for that company and its workers. Then I'll be joined by journalist Sarah Kessler of Quartz. Her new book is called Gigged: The End of the Job and the Future of Work. It looks at the so-called gig economy from the human side. She talked to people around the country who are trying to make ends meet by working for services like Uber, Amazon Turk, and TaskRabbit. And as always, we'll end with Don't Close My Tabs, some of the best things we saw online this week. All right, as you may have noticed, my co-host April Glazer is out this week, but we have a special guest co-host. I'm joined from Slate Studios in New York by Maya Kossoff, tech writer for Vanity Fair. Hey, Maya, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Hey, Will. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've followed your work for a long time, so I'm glad to get a chance to talk tech with you today. And I wanted to start with a story that you wrote recently about the electric scooter company Bird. And I'm going to go look at the headline here of what you wrote. This was maybe like 2 weeks ago, and it was your piece in Vanity Fair, and it was trying to explain how it could be possible that this electric scooter company nobody had heard of a few months earlier was suddenly seeking to raise money at a valuation of $1 billion. And so you made this like game attempt to sort of explain like, what are people thinking here? And now 2 weeks later, we get word this week that it is seeking to raise more money at a valuation of $2 billion. So Bird is definitely worth twice as much today as it was 2 weeks ago, right? That's a totally legitimate.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It reminds me a lot of like, it harkens back to like 2014, 2015, when any company could kind of go out and raise, $100 million at a $1 billion valuation. We went from having like a handful of billion-dollar unicorn companies to having, what, like 140 of them in the span of maybe like 18 months. There was a period of calm and quiet for a while, but Bird certainly harkens back to like the Uber fundraising days of 2014.
Yeah, why are people so excited about these things? I mean, all right, so I actually didn't think we had them down here on the Central Coast and in Santa Barbara, but I was wrong. I looked up today, and in the local news, apparently they just showed up here. There was a different company called Lime that tried to launch the electric scooters here, and they didn't get any permissions or anything from the city in true Silicon Valley startup style. And so the police went around impounding them, and they impounded like 150 of the 200 scooters on the first day. And now the city of Santa Barbara is trying to figure out what to allow and what not to allow. But what is the excitement? Like, why are these such a craze in some cities?
You know, it's so funny because electric scooters have existed on sidewalks and on streets for years, right? Like, this isn't new. It's the fact that they're monetizing it and making it a business that's new. Like, you could walk down the street in Flatiron in New York City and see, you know, any tech bro like on a scooter in 5 years ago. But the fact that it kind of reminds me of the Chinese bike sharing startups that took over China about a year or two ago. And that ended kind of disastrously. There were some good exits, but the big problem there was oversupply. And the rise of companies like Bird and Lime kind of reminds me of that a little bit. You suddenly have scooters strewn across the sidewalks in San Francisco. You have, cities impounding scooters. I think you saw that not only in Santa Barbara, but in Denver and in Nashville as well recently. And with the very same playbook that Uber and Lyft used, which is not surprising, by the way, because Bird is founded by a former Lyft and Uber executive, Travis Van der Zanden, is I believe his name.
Oh, good, another Travis. We need more Travises to disrupt transportation, don't we?
I think that's like the curse, right? Like, if you're a Travis and you live in Silicon Valley and you find yourself there, you have to disrupt some sort of transportation market. It's the rule.
That's the law, yeah.
They use the same playbook where it's like, let's not wait to be regulated. Let's kind of evince ourselves like in these cities. Let's put ourselves here and let's wait to see what regulators and cities say. And we'll build up a big user base in the meantime. That way, when we do have to fight regulators, we have this built-in fan base that can kind of go to bat for us.
It's so sad that works, but apparently it does. You just flood the zone until they've been normalized, and then you force the lawmakers to play catch up. But just to go back to basics for a second, so these are electric scooters, and the idea behind most of these startups is not that you buy them at Kmart, because buying things and owning them is tired. And what is wired is to rent these scooters and to get them on demand via your app on your phone, right? So you can just, you're like walking around San Francisco, or maybe not San Francisco anymore, because did they get kicked out of San Francisco?
They've been temporarily banned from San Francisco, and the city's making companies apply for permits for them. So you can't do it in San Francisco right now, but you could say in D.C. you're walking down the street and you want to hop a ride on a Bird scooter for some reason. And you open up the Bird app on your phone, and you can see what scooters have been, you know, left around in the area that you're in, and you can go use the app to unlock it. You kind of walk up to it, and you use the app to unlock it, and then you pay per minute and per mile. So you can go like a few miles on a scooter, and it costs less than taking an Uber or a Lyft or a cab would necessarily, and it'll get you there faster. That's kind of the pro scooter pitch.
And is there like an environmental, is there like a green pitch here too? Because I've seen a couple of the companies trying to make that pitch once they get cracked down on by local authorities. They're saying, look, this is a green form of transportation. We're making your city more walkable. You know, maybe people will be more likely to go without cars if they can hop a scooter to the train station or the bus stop or to work or that kind of thing. Do you buy that?
Not yet. I think it's still so new that it's hard to be able to really make that cogent argument. I feel like maybe we revisit this in a year and we see whether or not Bird and Lime have really had a tangible impact on the way that people get around cities and kind of move around. But it's still so new that, yes, of course you can say that, you know, we're getting people out of cars and we're getting people to kind of use their feet to get around. But it's, you know, we're only a few months into this experiment so far.
And already Bird is worth $2 billion. Why do they annoy people so much? I've heard that it's partly because, I guess, the fact that they lock automatically and they can only be unlocked by the app means you don't have to worry about putting them on a rack or whatever. And so people just leave these like strewn across the sidewalk or the street. I know that was why, I think that was the logic that Santa Barbara used to impound all these things.
Yeah, and I covered the scooters when they first made their way to San Francisco a couple months ago, and there was a lot of annoyance from even people working in tech, who you think would be the last people annoyed by these two-wheeled monstrosities on the sidewalk. But the main annoyance factor is, as you said, you can kind of leave them wherever, which is also the beauty of them to people who like them, is that you can then find them and pick them up and start using them whenever you want to. But one problem is that often what happens when people discover a scooter on the sidewalk using the app is that it's out of juice, like the battery is empty. So you can't necessarily hop on it and ride away. There was a really great piece in The Atlantic that Taylor Lorenz wrote, I think a month ago, about this whole economy that has kind of cropped up of people who will go collect dead birds' scooters on the sidewalk and charge them and then return them to the company. And then the company pays them money for doing that. So I think that Taylor talked to a teen who was making like $600 a night, picking up dead scooters on the sidewalk and then giving the fully charged ones back to the company at the end of the day. So that's kind of the annoyance factor, I think. I think also they're so obviously dorky. They're symbols of this like tech elitism that's fully penetrated, you know, Silicon Valley and the rest of the country. So it's like a very obvious symbol of a tech sentiment, if you will.
So it's like the Google Glass of transportation, or maybe if it catches on, it's the AirPods of transportation.
Yeah, exactly. It is like an equally unsexy Google Glass that you ride on a sidewalk or in a bike lane.
So let's move on to a less happy transportation story that just broke today. That's Tuesday. And that is that Tesla, the electric car juggernaut, has laid off 9% of its workforce. I don't have exact numbers on the headcount, but it's their total headcount is upwards of 30,000. So this is more than 3,000 people who were laid off today. CEO Elon Musk announced this in a tweet. It's not totally clear yet which sections of the company are most affected. One that you might not think of is the sales reps who had been working from Home Depots, where they were selling SolarCity solar panels, because SolarCity is now owned by Tesla. But I don't know exactly who's involved. It comes at a really interesting time for Tesla, and there's a lot to unpack here. But what was your reaction here? What was your first takeaway?
I guess my first thought was, well, what happens to the Model 3 now? Like, where does production stand with that? How much longer are we going to be delayed in getting these cars to market? How does this affect, you know, Musk's targets moving forward? And then also, I feel like this comes at a really interesting time for Elon Musk, too, because he's been in the news a lot recently, just for mouthing off on Twitter a lot, getting into fights with reporters,
dating Grimes.
So I have to wonder, I mean, it's a moment when I think he's been under increasing scrutiny from the press and even from just random people who might not have ever thought about him as like a personality otherwise. So I kind of wonder, you know, how this is all going to play out for him and also for the vehicles that he's supposed to be making and producing.
Yeah, so I did email Tesla, I was trying to get a little more clarification on who exactly is being laid off, and they told me that the people laid off are not production associates, which I assume means the people who are actually on the assembly line. And that might make sense. They're the ones who I believe are trying to organize and form a union right now, and there's actually a trial or a hearing going on at the National Labor Relations Board right now, where Tesla has been accused of union busting. But here, I guess they're looking to cut expenses elsewhere. The company assured me that this is not going to affect the production schedule for the Model 3. They say that they're quite confident and still achieving their goals. But it just, you know, they've been living on this edge. I mean, Elon Musk is permanently doing this high wire act where he's like, if he tips one way, he tips into like legend and greatness and changing the world. And if he tips the other way, he tips into bankruptcy and ignominy and disgrace. So which way do you see him tipping?
I don't know. I mean, he's been able to walk this walk for a long time. And I think a credulous press helps him do that. I think, the fact that anything he tweets becomes a news article on half a dozen websites is kind of testament to that fact. So to some capacity, I think he's able, and Tesla's able, to spin a lot of news that might otherwise be bad news as kind of neutral news, or maybe not good news, but they're able to kind of tamp down on really negative coverage. But I don't see this ending disastrously for him. I think his investors have all the patience in the world. And even when he mistreats analysts on earnings calls, like we saw during the last one a month or two ago, they seem pretty forgiving of him overall. So I don't know if their patience really has like an endpoint, or if it ever really runs out.
Yeah, it turns out that investors don't mind eating some poop if it makes them money. the thing that I come back to is that the cars are amazing. I mean, at least I haven't tried the Model 3 yet, but I was a Tesla skeptic at the outset, and I wrote a negative story, and then they were like, hey, why don't you come drive one? Why don't you come try one before you trash it again? And I drove it, and it was the most amazing driving experience I've ever had. And so that's why they inspire this crazy devotion, from their customers, I guess. And it does buy Musk more leeway than he might otherwise have.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I also wonder what the union drive effort, what comes of that after all of these layoffs. Obviously, these layoffs aren't affecting production people, but you have to wonder if maybe this inspires people to want to unionize, whether or not Musk would ever recognize some sort of union effort.
That's a great point. I hadn't even thought about that. But yeah, layoffs can catalyze a union drive sometimes, because everybody else gets scared and says, wow, I really do need this protection, even if they were skeptical before. Max Jacobs, our producer, has just let me know that there was some breaking news. The AT&T Time Warner merger, which we've talked about on the show before, has just been approved. So the fallout from that merger is definitely something we'll touch on next week's show. Also, in April's honor, since I'm sure she would be certain to mention it if she were on today, I should note that net neutrality officially died this week. She's been covering that as aggressively as ever, and you can read her piece, Day One of a Worse Internet, on our site, slate.com. All right, that'll do it for our news segment, but we'll have Maya back on at the end of the show for Don't Close My Tabs. First, time for a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have our interview with journalist Sarah Kessler about her new book, Gigged: The End of the Job and the Future of Work.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Our guest today is Sarah Kessler. She is the deputy editor of Quartz at Work. Previously, she covered the gig economy as a senior writer at Fast Company and managed startup coverage at Mashable. Her new book is called Gigged: The End of the Job and the Future of Work. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the basics. What is the gig economy? What is gig work, and how is it different from other kinds of work?
So that's a great question, and not everybody agrees on the answer. Some people, when they talk about the gig economy, they're only talking about startups like Uber, where you press a button and somebody comes and does something for you. Some people are talking about all freelancers. And some people talk about the gig economy as kind of part of this bigger trend in all sorts of different ways that people work other than 9-to-5 traditional jobs.
Okay, and so the gig economy, at least the narrative is that this has been growing rapidly, maybe over the past 5 years or so, as Uber and Lyft have entered the mainstream. You've got companies like Instacart and TaskRabbit. You have Amazon's Mechanical Turk. But I saw a report recently in the New York Times that questioned that. It said maybe the part of the economy in which people are not working as full-time employees actually hasn't grown in the past 10 years. What did you make of that report that came out? I believe that was data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Is the gig economy actually growing as fast as we've been told?
So it's interesting because I actually started kind of working on this back in 2011 when I was being pitched this narrative of, you know, oh gosh, we like have this app, and there were tons of startups pitching this. You're going to press a button and you're going to be able to work for whoever you want, whenever you want. You know, we were still recovering from the recession at that point, but then it was over. You know, unemployment was over because we had these apps. And so a lot of kind of the book and my reporting on the gig economy has kind of been pushing back on this narrative that this is the beginning of the future of work and all of our problems are over. So it's kind of been interesting because for the last several years, Bureau of Labor Statistics hasn't released data on this since 2005. But there have been, you know, numerous private studies or studies from the Federal Reserve and the Government Accountability Office that have said that this is growing. It's never been, this is the only work that people are doing. But then what's been interesting is now there's this almost overcorrection where the narrative is like, the gig economy doesn't exist and it's not important at all, which there's still 10 million people working this way, which to put that into context, I think 12 million people in the United States work in manufacturing. There are 3 million public school teachers in the United States. So it's a big group of people that exist and 7% of the workforce. The other thing that I think is that data has shown previously that like Uber is not a huge part of the workforce. A couple years ago, there was a study that suggested it was 0.5%. In my book, I called it a rounding error. So the idea that this has totally replaced work, you know, it shouldn't have been a surprise that that wasn't the case. What I think is interesting and important to think about is how these companies have demonstrated the possibilities for arranging work in new ways and the consequences of that.
What are some other examples of gig economy work that you explored in your book that might not be the first to jump to people's mind?
So I think that a lot of the ways that people use the gig economy was to talk about other work arrangements that are share problems, like having disadvantages when it comes to benefits or labor rights or workers' voice. And some of those are, for instance, I followed this guy who took phone calls for Sears in his trailer home apartment in rural Arkansas about like broken air conditioners. And he was, in fact, a independent contractor working for a small business that had a contract with a call center that had a contract with Sears. So he had, you know, when you call him, you think he works for Sears, but he has no, you know, relationship whatsoever with Sears or anyone who works at Sears. And so there's this kind of process of kind of dissolving of the direct employment relationship, which the gig economy is not, you know, the whole story when it comes to that, but it is an example. And it's one that politicians, I think, especially use to talk about this bigger trend.
What did you find in terms of, was there a pattern in the people that you spent time with as to who seemed to benefit from these opportunities, or what sorts of people were positioned to take advantage of these opportunities versus the sort of people for whom they either just replaced other work that was equally unsatisfying or actually left them somehow worse off than they might have been otherwise?
Yeah, and I think that the split is probably pretty obvious. You know, I followed a computer programmer who worked in New York who was bored of his job, and he quit and joined this app that routed him programming jobs. Before he did that, he had saved a year's worth of living expenses. He'd purchased insurance and hired an accountant to make sure he was setting aside enough money in his taxes. Made $12,000 his first month. You know, never been happier. If he got called to jury duty and couldn't work, you know, it wasn't a big deal. He just kind of did more work next week and used his savings to buy groceries. So the loss of kind of, you know, if you're working as an independent contractor, you don't have access to things like unemployment insurance or sick leave or, you know, any possibility that your employer is providing you health insurance. You probably don't know what kind of work you might get next week. That's a lot bigger problem if you don't have a year's worth of savings. And so even kind of people who may have enjoyed working this way and enjoyed the flexibility and independence kind of had this idea in the back of their head, like, oh, this will work, like, unless something goes wrong, like, or unless I want to have kids, you know, as long as I don't want to retire, which is a lot of a different story. And I think that that's important because if you are somebody who has highly in demand creative skills or professional skills, you might be able to not think of the loss of kind of that safety net and social insurance as a big deal. But if you don't have those things, it really is a much bigger deal.
Right. So there are some people who are doing the proverbial side hustle. And for them, maybe it works really well. I, living out here in Goleta, California, I have Uber drivers who are retired, and they're a lot of times they're way better off financially than I am. They have million-dollar homes, but they were just lonely and they wanted something to do during the day. But as far as the supposed promise of the gig economy for providing work to people who don't otherwise have it, it sounds like you didn't see a lot of hope in that regard. I mean, you didn't see this necessarily as a solution for folks who are otherwise out of work?
Yeah, I mean, kind of the nonprofit that I followed is a great example of this. They kind of heard this pitch about, you know, press a button and get to work. And they went to Arkansas, where in this town where 40% of people live in poverty and there aren't a lot of good job opportunities, and said, okay, like, there aren't good opportunities here, but if we teach you how to use this online freelance program, you can access opportunity anywhere. And the problem they kind of quickly discovered is that the same things are working against you when you're competing for online jobs as they are when you're competing for offline jobs. And those are not a matter of just kind of plugging into a interface. You know, there's differences in education and experience and expectations. And there's, you know, racism when you're in the workplace in the physical world, and there's racism online. I mean, if you think about it, that we should have all, and the media narrative should have immediately questioned that an app can solve poverty and unemployment. That just, it's just way more complicated than that.
Did you come away from this thinking that there really are some other ways? Maybe the gig economy isn't solving unemployment, but are there other things that it is doing that you think offer a real promise for the future?
Yeah, I think that you know, the ways in which it works well for the programmers would also be ways that it could work really well for everybody. You know, kind of our idea of a full-time job we conceived at a time when we thought an ideal family would include a woman who stayed at home all day taking care of the children in the house. And to the extent that that was ever typical, it is less so typical today. And so you have these people trying to juggle so much with two full-time, you know, careers that are all scheduled during the same hours. And this could really be a way to help with that. Or you have people living much longer than they used to. And not only that, but living healthy lives longer than they used to. And so the idea of, you know, a 60-year career is something that is actually, that might happen. And the idea that we're all going to go to the office from 9 to 5 for 60 years, it also seems less than ideal. And so, you know, maybe that this could somehow help with that. And then I also think what is kind of important about this story was the reason that I thought it was interesting is that it, in the process, kind of demonstrated all these problems with the larger economy and who it works for and who it doesn't, and weaknesses in the way that we support workers in general. And so there are a lot of problems that came up with the gig economy and a lot of solutions that were proposed for it that, if we actually followed through with some of those solutions, would benefit not only Uber drivers, but like a much bigger swath of the workforce.
So what's an example of one of those solutions that could help?
So, for instance, portable benefits, which is this idea that like your health insurance shouldn't be attached to your job. You should be able to, as an individual, have a way to buy health insurance, or your employers, if you work for five different places, should be able to all contribute if we're going to keep it as kind of a employer-funded thing. I think that's probably the main one. We're the only kind of developed country that attaches the whole social safety net to a job. And there's a lot of problems that causes, not just for people working in the gig economy.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about that I've seen a lot of argument about is whether you can make a decent wage working gig economy jobs, whether it's, you know, there's arguments about whether you can make ends meet working full time as an Uber driver, or how many hours you'd have to drive per day. I imagine similar arguments, you know, if you're an Instacart shopper or whatever else. What did you find with the people that you spent time with? Were they making it a decent wage, or did it really vary widely?
It varied widely, and I think that one of the things that was most important is that it was hard to tell how much it would be, you know, while you were in it. You know, Uber will shift its fares all the time and like send you emails about, like, oh, if you drive this weekend, it'll be one rate, but if you want to drive today, it'll be much less. And so you get everybody kind of trying to game the system and understand how much they're going to make, and they don't really. And then there were people who were making it work and work good, like the programmer who I followed. And then I guess there were people who were making it work, but it looked painful. Like, I followed this woman who made a living on Amazon Mechanical Turk. So a common task on Mechanical Turk is, you know, label these 10,000 pictures. Some of them are cats and some of them are dogs. Choose which label is which. So these are very small tasks that are put out to a crowd of people that can do them for cents apiece. So this woman, her husband lost his job at the height of the recession, and she kind of, you know, stepped up and said, okay, well, I need to figure out how to make more money quick. I know that I can just sign up for Mechanical Turk right now, you know, without going to an interview or looking for a job or having to have experience. And she made $40,000 a year, like 5 cents at a time.
That's incredible.
And the way she did it was really smart. Like, she would set up, you know, shortcuts on her keyboard. So like, if the answer was cat, she would just have to press C and it would automatically select cat and submit it instead of doing all the mouse clicks. Or she had, like, you know, set up alarms on a forum where other workers were alerting each other to good jobs. So like, if something were posted there, an alarm would go off and she would be like, oh gosh, I gotta go grab that. But she was working, you know, she was sleeping in her office in case like the alarm were to go off at night, and working insane hours and getting, you know, repetitive stress injuries, but working through them because she couldn't afford to take a break, and like not getting surgery because she couldn't afford the prescriptions. Like, so, you know, you're like, okay, like this work was available instantly when she needed it. And maybe that's like a good thing. But like, I don't know that we can feel really good about that job opportunity.
Sarah Kessler, thank you so much for joining us. Your book, Gigged, is really good, and I recommend it to anyone who's interested in getting a deeper, fuller picture of what the gig economy looks like in practice. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
One last break, and then don't close my tabs. Some of the best things we saw online this week.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
And now let's welcome back our guest co-host, Maya Kossoff. Maya, what tab could you not close this week?
So my tab this week comes from Wired. It's a story called Inside Palmer Luckey's Bid to Build a Border Wall. And as you'll recall, Palmer Luckey, who left Facebook and Oculus at some point over the past year, he's a Trump supporter. He donated to the 2016 Trump campaign. He gave money to an alt-right super PAC that funded anti-Hillary Clinton memes in 2016. He is building a virtual border wall. He wants his company, which is called Anduril, which is another Lord of the Rings reference, like Palantir, to basically be a Lockheed Martin competitor. He wants it to be a tech startup that combines VR with surveillance tools and basically allows the government to surveil the border between the U.S. and Mexico without building a physical wall.
All right. So Palmer Luckey was, I believe he was fired from Facebook, right? Or he like at least exited not under good terms. Was it partly because he was, because of the dank memes that he was posting on Reddit, the Donald? Is that, do you remember?
I think it was part of it. I think what he insinuates in this Wired interview with Stephen Levy is that he had made some enemies at Facebook. And I think part of that had to have been ideological.
Yeah, no doubt. And so now he's going to embrace his new identity as the pro-Trump entrepreneur and build a virtual border wall. Did you get a sense of what that actually looks like? I mean, is this like putting VR cameras all along the border? Because that sounds sort of expensive and also not great if it rains.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the gist is basically that you're going to be able to you know, there will be VR elements to it, and then there's also going to be like drones and cameras. And so in a lot of respects, what he's propositioning here is not like a lot different than other sort of proposals that we've heard in the past for border wall tech. This one happens to be Palmer Luckey branded and got a Wired profile. But, you know, and that might be a good selling point for the U.S. government. I don't know. But I guess we'll see. It's interesting to me that he's kind of embracing his iconoclasm and following in the footsteps of people like, say, Peter Thiel. There aren't many people like this in Silicon Valley who are, you know, openly, I wouldn't even call Thiel, you know, Thiel certainly isn't, he's hard to put into like a political box. He's pro-Trump. They're both pro-Trump. There's not many pro-Trump people, openly pro-Trump people in Silicon Valley. And these two have really just leaned all the way into it.
Except for the part where Peter Thiel moved down to Southern California because he couldn't bear the political culture in Silicon Valley anymore. But yeah, it's interesting. Surveillance tech seems to really be the play if you're a pro-Trump entrepreneur.
Will, what was your tab this week?
My tab this week comes from journalists who were in Singapore this week covering the big nuclear summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un of North Korea. Several of the journalists reported that they had been given a sort of swag bag by the organizers of the summit. One of the items in there was a mini USB fan, a little fan that you plug into your USB port, and I guess your computer will power it and, I don't know, cool you off while you work. But there was a clear lesson here from, like, all the security people on Twitter in unison screamed, do not put that in your USB port. And so this is news you can use. If a foreign government, or even our government, I would say, gives you a free thumb drive or any other device and suggests that you plug it into your computer, don't do that, because it could have any number of types of malware or spyware or whatever else attached to it.
I think you're being kind of mean. I think that, I think a USB fan is a great gift from any government, and I would be happy to have one.
You would rock that USB fan.
I would, yes, absolutely, any day.
I was on a trip to Singapore with some journalists and policy types a few years ago, and they gave us a thumb drive, actually, and I did not have security experts on Twitter to tell me not to put it into my computer, but luckily for once I exercised a little common sense and threw it in the trash.
You should have given it to a security researcher and seen what if anything was lurking on there.
Now I know. That's the play. You give it to the security researcher. Maya, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It was a lot of fun, and your coverage at Vanity Fair is fantastic. I would urge everybody to go check it out.
Thank you so much, Will.
All right, that's our show for this week. You can get updates about what's coming up next by following us on Twitter at IfThenPod. You can also email us at ifthen@slate.com. Send us your tech questions, show and guest suggestions, or just say hi. You can follow me and April on Twitter as well. I'm at Will Arimus, and April is at April Laser. Thanks again to our guest, Sarah Kessler. You can follow her on Twitter at Sarah F. Kessler. And thanks to our guest co-host, Maya Kossoff. You can find her at M.E. Kossoff. That's M-E-K-O-S-O-F-F. And if you like the show, please leave us a comment or a review on iTunes. We would be forever grateful. It really helps boost our show, and it's one of the few ways that we can get it out to new listeners to hear it. Thanks so much. If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. Our producer is Max Jacobs. Thanks to Don Aulis at A Room with a VU in Santa Barbara, and thanks to Shasha Leonard at Slate in Brooklyn. We'll see you next week.